process to expand time, and on cases where there are multiple parties or time, such a motion is appropriate. We didn't have one, so we hadn't planned on it.
I have learned my lesson, believe me.
Just ask.
Well, we asked for a continuance, and that got turned down, so.
We were eager to see you.
The next case is the matter of the guardianship of James Halligan.
May it please the court. My name is Karen Bertram. I represent Victoria Halligan in this appeal. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Contrary to what the trustees argue, Ms. Halligan is not trying to change her parents' estate plan. On the contrary, she is trying to enforce the specific provisions of that estate plan. Article 8, paragraph B of the Halligan Trust explicitly allows the surviving trustor to change the trustee, to remove and replace the trustee at any time with anyone. The trial court erred when it refused to permit Pat Halligan's guardian to exercise his absolute right to remove and replace the trustee.
So what is there any role for the court in reviewing or to review the guardian's actions in exercising the ward's right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's that role?
The role is to supervise what the guardian is doing. And all of the case law that I read in under Washington law says that the court pays particular attention to the views of the guardian because it's the guardian who is close to the subject and knows what is best for the incapacitated person. So the court, while supervises guardianships, will defer to the decision-making of the guardian.
Is the court required to defer? If not, what's the standard that the court applies in determining whether to defer?
The standard is best interest. And in this particular case, it is undeniably in the best interest of the capacitated person to preserve his estate for his care. And we're not talking about a few cents here. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars a year that could be saved in trustee fees.
So is your contention, and I think you've just described it, but I want to be sure. So your contention is not that the trial court applied the wrong standard to the dispute, but rather the trial court reached the wrong conclusion upon applying the correct standard.
Yes, I think the court erred in a couple of ways. First, it substituted its judgment for the judgment of the guardian, which I believe was not supported by the record. The court specifically decided that because Mr. Halligan had designated these particular trustees in the trust agreement, that there was no reason to change them. The other is that the court completely ignored the plain language of the trust agreement, which explicitly allows the surviving trustor to change the trustee.
But Mr. Halligan wasn't doing that. His guardian was.
That's right. And
so
his guardian.
If Mr. Halligan was free of the need for a guardian and engaging in his own endeavors, then there would be no role for the court
There would be no role for the court.
Okay.
And he would have the absolute right to make those changes.
So the court has a role here only because it is not Mr. Halligan who is making that decision, but
correct.
Rather someone appointed by the court to make decisions for Mr. Halligan.
That's correct.
Okay. And that is in some way then, and I think it's limiting, and I think it's limiting in the way that we previously described, upon an unfettered power. And Mr. Halligan, making his own decision, had an unfettered power
to
change for any reason whatsoever or no reason.
Correct. Guardians don't have that kind of unfettered power.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
But in this case, the power granted under paragraph B can be exercised by another person, such as their guardian. The language of the trust actually defines the powers that are personal to the trustors in Article 7, paragraph C. But Article 8, paragraph B, does not state that those powers are personal to the trustor, and therefore they can and should be exercised by the guardian if it's in the best interest of the incapacitated person.
So would it be correct to paraphrase your argument so far as being that this case comes down to a simple proposition? Did Judge Churchill err in concluding that the guardian's desire to change was at variance with the best interests of Mr. Halligan? That's the one question that's presented when we get right down to it, right?
I think it's broader than that, Your Honor. I think it's broader than that because the basis for her ruling was not supported by the record, and the basis for her ruling was inconsistent with the best interests of the incapacitated person. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Gail Mautner for respondents, the current co-trustees, the Northern Trust Company, and Mr. David Del Sesto. At issue in this case is exactly what the Court has identified, whether a change of trustee is in Mr. Halligan's best interest. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. Judge Churchill determined that it was not in his best interest, and we submit that the appellants have not met their burden of showing an abuse of discretion. The related issue posed by the guardian here is who gets to decide and how much deference. And we have absolutely no argument that the guardian is free to ask the court for authority to do something that the guardian believes to be in the ward's best interest, and she did so. But there is not in Washington law currently the sort of deference that counsel just argued for. The two cases she's referring to were a 1924 and a 1930 case. Neither has been cited since then for that proposition. And to the contrary, the answer to the question of who gets to decide is that the guardian shall at all times be under the general direction and control of the court making the appointment, that's RCW 1192-010, and that fundamentally it is a level playing field. There is no deference, and that's from a guardianship of Lamb, a 2011 case, and I'm going to break the cardinal rule, Your Honors, I'm going to read to you. The court need not place on any party any particular burden of proof or persuasion, nor give any presumption of validity to the petition of the guardian. Thus, while the guardian has the authority to assert the incapacitated person's rights and best interests, it remains at all times the responsibility of the court to make the decision as to the ward's best interest. The goal of a guardianship is to do what the ward would do if the ward were competent to make the decision in question. It's exactly what Judge Churchill evaluated, made a decision on, and the guardian disagrees with that decision. But under the standard of review, you should only reverse if you find an abuse of discretion. And here, I specifically want to talk about the amount of evidence and the type of evidence that was before Judge Churchill. What did she consider? She considered evidence within the trust instrument itself, which showed the high degree of confidence that the trustors had in Mr. Del Sesto and in Northern Trust. Certainly, obviously, because they were selected, but also because Mr. Del Sesto was specifically vested with the power to replace Northern, but only with a corporate trustee that had 80% of the amount of funds under management that Northern had. And further, the trust provided that if Mr. Del Sesto could not serve, the Northern Trust could serve alone. This is an indication of trustor intent. What other evidence is there of trustor intent? Three witnesses, Mr. Del Sesto, Mr. Hardkey of Northern Trust, and Denicia Halligan, one of Mr. Halligan's other children, each testified that Mr. and Mrs. Halligan did not want their children involved in managing any of their businesses or assets, including choosing trustees. Mrs. Halligan appointed Northern Trust and Mr. Del Sesto as executors under her will. Mr. and Mrs. Halligan both appointed Mr. Del Sesto as sole trustee of the trust they established for the benefit of their three children. So that's trustor intent. I want to specifically address the argument that the guardian can exercise Mr. Halligan's personal right to remove and replace a trustee for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason at all. You've correctly identified that he can do it for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason at all. The reason that Ms. Halligan cannot stand in his shoes is that she is a guardian appointed by the court, not nominated by him, and not in that intermediate level, not even his attorney in fact. And that is a fundamental difference because she is 100% subject to the court's decision-making authority when she acts as guardian. And this court also has previously ruled, in fact, that the guardian is essentially the agent of the superior court. But what else was there before the court in making its decision? Mr. Del Sesto's longstanding relationship with Mr. and Mrs. Halligan and his decades-long experience with management of the trust assets. That was before the court. Testimony by Ms. Halligan's sister, Denicia, that Mr. Del Sesto was completely trusted by her parents, that he managed her parents' property quite profitably, that Ms. Halligan, Victoria Halligan, had never been involved in any of her parents' business affairs, and that their parents vehemently opposed any control by Ms. Halligan. There were descriptions of the very complex and substantial assets that Northern Trust and Mr. Del Sesto had been managing since Mrs. Halligan's death. The investment of the co-trustees into learning and understanding what needed to be done and their ongoing activities.
The rates and fees gone up subsequent to the death?
No, Your Honor, they went down. So what evidence, I'll do a jump, Your Honor. What evidence was there regarding fees? Mr. Del Sesto testified that Mr. and Mrs. Halligan were aware of the fees charged by Northern Trust. Ms. Halligan incorrectly claims that there's nothing in the trust about fees, but that's not the case. Article 8, Section E, specifically says the trustee may receive reasonable compensation. And as we argued to Judge Churchill, if Ms. Halligan believes the fee is not reasonable, attack the fee. Don't remove the trustees who were selected by the trustor and who have done nothing wrong. So I want to make sure I'm correctly answering your question. Did you say since Mrs. Halligan's death, or did you say since that first year? I may have misunderstood the question.
I asked about the death, but my interest was as compared to when they selected the trustees and undertook it, had the fees gone?
The actual fees being charged are discounted and therefore less than the fee schedule that was shared with them. That's that's the case. The guardian's evidence, and the guardian submitted evidence, there's no question. She had, number one, she found a potential new trustee who would charge less. Now, the initial petition contained only a declaration from Ms. Halligan, and we didn't receive declarations from Whittier Trust until we got the reply on the initial motion, so we never got to depose them. We don't know what was included in the basic quote versus any additional fees or whether it's a first-year sort of loss leader with a commitment to continue. But let's assume hypothetically that Whittier could continue to do this for less than Northern Trust. We know from the Powell case that cost alone is an insufficient basis to remove the trustee. The second argument was the guardian's speculation that in the second year, the co-trustee's fees might go beyond what was in the first year and amount to 160 basis points. But there's no evidence in the record, and in fact, there was a disclaimer of that by the trustee in the February 4th, 2015 letter, which is CP 62 to 63, and specifically stated that the intent was to, again, discount for the combined fees of both to be a discount from Northern Trust's standard sole fee. So the court considered all of that and reached its own decision. My anticipation is that Ms. Halligan's rebuttal time may be utilized to address something that she raised as a new theory in her motion for consideration, wholly improper under CR 59, and did not cite to the sealed medical report until her reply before this court, so we didn't have a chance in any kind of briefing to address it. But the reply brief in before this court incorrectly states that the physician who conducted the exams in 2014 had been Pat Halligan's primary care internist since 1994. Take a look at the medical report. That is not what it says. It says that Dr. Fisher has been a primary care internist since 1994. All you can glean from the medical report is that he examined him for the first time in 2014. So there's no way that someone can make a determination about his capacity in 2008 from that. Similarly,
I want to take advantage of the last 30 seconds we've got just to make sure that everybody's on the same page. There was some scuffling in the briefing about what the guardian could do or not do. It appears that over the course of the argument, both sides are in agreement that the guardian in this case, notwithstanding statutes, the wording of the particular documents at issue, but in this case, this guardian could come in and ask the Superior Court for the relief that the guardian requested, and we're just down to an abuse of discretion standard on Judge Churchill's decision to deny that request.
Yes, Your Honor, that is absolutely the case, and we would urge the court to affirm Judge Churchill because with the evidence before her, she did not abuse her discretion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Churchill did abuse her discretion. It is the court's responsibility to give effect to the trustor's intent. The trustors in this case intended to be able to change the trustees whenever they wanted to whomever they wanted. It was an abuse of her discretion to not give effect to the provisions of the trust. The arguments by the trustees, I want to address a couple of them. Your question with regard to fees. There is no evidence that the Halligans were provided any information regarding what the trustees' fees, the double trustees' fees, would be back in 2008 when the amendment to their trust was signed. There was a comment that Whittier Trust might just be giving a lower rate as a loss leader, and then they were going to charge their higher rates. The declaration from Paul Cantor at Whittier Trust specifically says that the fees would be ongoing at exactly the same rate and would not be raised. Council spent a lot of time talking about whether or not there was good cause to change these trustees. There is no requirement for good cause. the good cause standard in 1198.039 simply does not apply because the trust instrument specifically says that they can change the trustee. And the guardian can stand in the position of Mr. Halligan, who, if he were had capacity, would make that same decision to save $500,000 a year in trustees' fees. And it's unreasonable to think that he would not.
Let me ask you one remaining question. There was the document that was filed under seal. You cited to it in your briefing, and counsel has argued about it to us. Do you agree that under these circumstances, it's totally appropriate for the court to both review that document and refer to it in the opinion? Notwithstanding that it was once sealed, it seems that both parties have acted inconsistent with that document remaining sealed, you by citing it in your brief and opposing counsel by arguing about it. And I'm just saying, does anybody have any quibble with us actually referencing?
I think it's a little bit of a red herring because there is no argument about Mr. Halligan's capacity in terms of the enforceability of the trust agreement itself. We're not arguing that he lacked capacity.
I assume that the answer to my question was, does anybody have a problem with it? I assume the answer I received was no.
Yes, sir.
Again, we were talking about the merits of it.
Sorry, for carrying on.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our calendar today. Court is in recess.